and welcome to the Kate Turkington Show. Now, I wonder if you knew. I mean, we know prisons are an absolute dilemma, a stronger word than dilemma, nationwide, internationally. But did you know that in South Africa, we actually have the biggest prison population in Africa? I mean, just think how big Africa is. That's really a stunning kind of statistic. Behind prison walls, lives unfold that most of us know absolutely nothing about. And my guest today, Judge Edwin Cameron, is going to take us inside prison walls. His new book is called Behind Prison Walls, and he's published it with Rebecca Gore, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right. Is it Sohela Suresh-Pal? Is that how we pronounce it? Okay. He's co-written this book, Behind Prison Walls. It's published by Tafelberg. And my word, it's such a powerful book. I've been thinking about it ever since I read about it, and also talking to people about it, because, you know, prisoners, prison walls, you know, we don't really like to think about these things, you know, we who are secure in our own little bubbles or whatever. So welcome, Judge Cameron. I'm going to call you Edwin, because we've known one another a very long time. I want to ask you, well, first of all, congratulations on the book, because it is, I can only call it an expose. It's an awful overworked word, but that's what it is. But I want to ask you, when you went behind prison walls for this book, we'll talk about other ventures in a bit later. When you first went behind prison walls, how did you go? Did you go as a judge? Did you go as a witness? Or did you go just as an ordinary human being who wanted to know what was going on? Awful overworked word, but that's what it is. But I want to ask you, when you went behind prison walls for this book, we'll talk about other ventures in a bit later. When you first went behind prison walls, how did you go? Did you go as a judge? Did you go as a witness? Or did you go just as an ordinary human being who wanted to know what was going on?
Definitely the latter, Kate. And of course, my first visit to a prison was as a student at Stellenbosch. I was 23 or 24 years old. I was about to go to Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar, and I got a VAC job with a judge of the old Transvaal Supreme Court, Douglas Davidson. And we visited a prison because he was on circuit in Vereeniging, and it left a profound impression on me still today, all these years later.
In what way? How?
Kate, the first thing that it did was that we went to the women's section of the Vereeniging jail, because the circuit was in Vereeniging, and all the women were arrayed before us in the interior courtyard, and he said to them a very savvy question, which I hadn't anticipated. He said, "How many of you are here for Dacha?" And a sea of hands. These women, and I hope it's not condescending to call them mamas, they were ordinary women, maternally aged women who had been doing what women across the southeastern coast of Africa have been doing for centuries, which is cultivating and selling Dacha. And Connie Mulder's minimum sentences 5 years before had made it compulsory to go to prison if you had a matchbox full of Dacha, 112 grams. The presumption kicked in and you had to go to jail for a minimum of 5 years, less than a matchbox full, a minimum of 2 years. So that left a searing impression on me about many things that we still deal with today, Kate, including minimum sentences and the evil of minimum sentences.
That's actually something I want to ask you. You say, and I quote, well, sort of a quote, a paraphrase, "Overlong sentences and definitions of overbroad crimes took a wrong turn in the early days of our democracy. Please, won't you explain that? Because I think I didn't know about bail and just a layperson's explanation.
Kate, we were all terrified after the Mandela transition. The black middle class, which was then much smaller than it is now, and of course whites. And the first Mandela parliament was concerned to deal with what they thought, as it turns out wrongly, the statistics now show us, was a crime wave. So they turned to Clinton's America and Tony Blair's UK, and they introduced to our democracy this evil of longer sentences for more offences with minimum, no parole period, no bail, life sentences. We had 495 people serving life sentences in 1995. We now have 19,600. And you're right to cover your eyes, Kate, and we can unpack. This is not a bleeding heart story. This is a story of a wrong policy choice, and every wrong policy choice we make in our country is a missed opportunity. And that's the argument of our book, which is fundamentally a hopeful book, which says we can do something about all of this.
So Edwin, what happens? Let's say I get arrested for shoplifting. What happens to me? What's the process?
Kate, you are arraigned by the police, pass a docket on to the National Prosecuting Authority. You may or may not have been given bail. You can be given police bail, and you can be given bail even when the prosecutor relents if it's shoplifting. So then the NPA decides whether to prosecute you or not, and you go to court and you've got to plead, and then you sentence. Luckily for shoplifting and for minor thefts, there's no minimum sentences. But for a huge array of other offences, there are minimum sentences. So what we are doing, and this is the argument of the book, we are sending a smaller and smaller proportion of serious criminals, violent criminals, murderers and rapists, to jail for longer and longer. So we are not dealing with the crime wave. The other statistic that I'd love to give our viewers and listeners now, Kate, is that if you commit a murder, and you were making a joke about punching people in the face earlier, Kate, if you commit a murder now, after our podcast, you only have an 11% risk of being convicted and sent to jail. 89% of the murderers in our country are untouched. And yet, those we corner, the rapists we corner, we send to jail without a parole period for 25 years, and we think we're doing our job, we're not.
Now, you're a judge, you're in a position of power and prominence. Can the law be changed?
Definitely. Kate, we don't say to people, and I meet people very often whose children have been murdered or raped and whose homes have been broken into, who've been threatened by violent criminals. You and I, all of us, all our listeners and viewers, are terrified of crime, and rightly, we've got one of the highest rates of violent crime in the world. So we don't say set everyone free and stop the minimum sentence. We say start with what works. And we know what works. Crime containment is not in long sentences. It's not in sending a tiny portion of people away forever. Crime containment is in consequences. And this is a terrible thing to say, but I'd like your viewers and listeners to hear it, Kate. The international regulation sentence for rape is 6 to 9 years, which is not to say that some rapists shouldn't be sent away forever. And I know some rapes which are as horrible as that. But that's what internationally, the UK and US and Western Europe and Japan and Australasia, it's compulsory in our country to send away for life. So what we are saying is stop, make sure that every single rapist goes to jail for a shorter period, not a tiny proportion who go to jail forever. That's the argument.
You're And I mean, it's common sense, because your stories of going behind prison walls are harrowing, and the photographs are harrowing. When are people watching and listening, read the book, get hold of the book? Anybody who's interested in justice or our society must read this book. When you see these photos of cells that were built for 20 with 60 people in, and the mattresses are side by side, there's not even a bar between one bunk and another. What hope has a youngster got if he gets, he, she, they get sent into a prison in that situation? They're going to be brutalized, dehumanized, and will probably become criminal. Is that your experience?
Exactly, Kate. You've summarized it very well, and thank you for raising this human dimension. They're going to be recruited into gangs. They're going to get tattooed. We've seen that happen. We went to Mossel Bay Youth Center 2 or 3 weeks ago, and we went to the children's section. We're talking about kids as young as 15 who are tattooing each other. And this is a whole, it's a whole social problem, Kate. We know that the Cape Flats are gang-ridden, and we know, we make the argument in the book that the criminalization of drugs contributes to the murder rate and to the degradation of youngsters, kids like those we saw in Mossel Bay.
Now, just decode that for me, the criminalization of drugs.
Kate, smoking is wrong, we don't criminalize smoking. Drinking is wrong, they tried criminalizing it for 12 years in the States. The result was catastrophic. It led to the mafia. That's what drug crime does. And it's not a far-fetched thing. Former President Kgalema Motlanthe has joined a group of international presidents who say, stop this terribly miscast, misdirected, destructive war on drugs and find other solutions. Treat it like alcohol and tobacco as a public health problem. Now, we don't say that fentanyl doesn't do terrible damage. We acknowledge that. But they're public health interventions that work. And they've shown it in Portugal. They've shown it in some American states, which is not to say that there's a magic bullet. We acknowledge in the book that Oregon, for example, has had some mixed experiences. Portugal has adapted its drug crime-free policy. But we can do better with all these things. You asked me very perceptively a few minutes ago, can we fix this? And these are the solutions that we propose. But starting, if I may go back for a moment, Kate, start with crime intelligence. Our crime rate was coming down from 1994 to 2011. Then we had the Zuma presidency. And President Zuma appoints a criminal, whom I'm going to name, Mr. Richard Mdluli, to head crime intelligence. He wrecks crime intelligence the way he wrecks the prosecution, the police, the tax service. We've not had an effective crime intelligence service. We've heard the last few weeks how they are fighting with each other. They're looting. I'm not naming names because...
And murdering.
Yeah, exactly. So, Kate, we say start with crime intelligence. Appoint someone competent and of utter probity to rebuild crime intelligence. You'll stop the copper cable thefts, the extortion rackets, the kidnappings, the ATM blasts, the cash and transit heists. All of these problems have criminal syndicates behind them. And you've got to start with crime intelligence. You've got to start with the police and with the prosecution.
Crime intelligence sounds a bit like a Netflix soapy or something, or MI5 or CIA. Crime intelligence, what is the role of crime intelligence?
Kate, who is going to commit the next cash and transit heist? These are murderous people who are quite willing to set security guards who are working for a pittance for the cash transit companies alight inside their vehicles. How do you find out? Those gangs have got mothers and fathers and girlfriends and boyfriends and neighbors. You can penetrate those gangs with an efficient crime intelligence service where you pay honest informants and not loot the money yourself to build yourself, to buy yourself Lamborghinis or houses in Centurion. So, Kate, it's possible to run an efficient crime intelligence service which will crack all these syndicates. The real trouble, of course, and we have to acknowledge this, we acknowledge this in the book, is that crime intelligence is going to lead the police, the reformed police and the reformed prosecuting authority, right into the cabinet. President Zuma has people inside his cabinet, I would count 4 or 5, there may be more, who are deeply involved in the criminal syndicates. So that's why we have this national inertia, which is affecting you and me and every single one of our listeners and viewers right now.
I like that expression, national inertia, because it leads me on. You've just made me think of it, actually. I've got a lot of grandchildren. I know a lot of young people. What role models do they have? And I'm going into off-art mode for a moment. But you know, when I was growing up, when dinosaurs ruled the earth, there were people of global distinction, people one looked up to. Maybe, you know, the tall poppy syndrome has happened, and they've lost a bit of luster over the decades. But we were brought up, generations were brought up to be truthful, to be decent. I was interviewing a lovely author not so long ago. I don't know if you've ever read the number one latest Detective
I have.
Agency series. Lovely.
Sandy.
Alexander McCall Smith. And we were chatting.
Yes.
And I said, but Precious Ramotswe, his main character, I said, she's just such a decent character. And he stopped me in my tracks. He said, you know, I haven't heard anybody use that word for so long. How our parents, your parents, used to say, such a decent man, such a decent woman. So there is so no role, or very few role models. You talk about national inertia, you look at global leaders, and obviously we look across at America and whatever, where blatant criminality is happening in front of everybody. How can we tell our youth? What can we do? Are we not like, I'm mixing a lot of metaphors here. It's a bit like Sisyphus and his boulder. We're rolling it up and it's just rolling down again. Do you genuinely believe we can make a difference? I know you believe we should make a difference.
We can, Kate, and let me make 2 points. The one is that President Masisi of Botswana appointed me to the Botswana Co Court of Appeal. For 6 weeks, twice a year, I cross the border. Same people, same Setswana speakers, our country people, all these borders are colonially imposed. Much, much, much lower crime rate. We can do it, Kate. The second point I want to make is that I was privileged at the Constitutional Court, and now with my co-authors, whom you rightly honor, Rebecca and Sahel, who wrote most of the book, by the way. I'm alphabetically privileged. But Kate, let me say that I worked with about 30 or 40 youngsters, mostly women and mostly black people, at the Concourt and at the inspectorate that I now head. And I must say, Kate, we've got the people, we've got the decency, we've got people who want our country to work. We are in the hands of a tiny minority who are looting us all. We've got such promise. You can go into any Woolworths or any bank or any enterprise which is run by our country's people, black and white, gay and straight, man and women, and the decency is there, Kate. So I don't think it's past. I think that you've got to be systematic. It's not pie in the sky. There's no magic bullet. I haven't got a magic bullet. No police general parading on television has got a magic bullet. We've got to be careful of anyone who preaches magic bullets. There's no quick fix, but there are longer term fixes. The example I like to use, Kate, I'm here with you right now because of antiretrovirals. I was deathly sick 28 years ago, November 1997. I was going to die, median survival time with full-blown AIDS, 24 to 30 months. And I started ARVs 28 years. Now, the point is that we didn't have an antiretroviral program. On the contrary, we had a president who refused it. The Treatment Action Campaign took to the streets. The courts did the right thing. Justice Chaskalson, Justice Pius and Nkonzalanga, the unanimous court. We then managed to get the world's largest publicly provided ARV program. 7 million people, as we listen and talk now, are like me, have their lives saved. So, Kate, that's just an example of what we can do in our country with people of purpose and determination and principle. We've got lots. I know them. I have said on public platforms that I would take my cadre of 30 law clerks and put them in the cabinet. They would run the country magnificently.
So you're saying, and this is my experience too with young people, the will is there. The will is there. How do we get that will working? What can we do? What can be done?
We do start with leadership. Let me start at the other end. The Treatment Action Campaign fought leadership. So we also have to, I think there's a widespread belief, which I can't enter into because I'm still a judge doing a judge job, and I mustn't get ticked off by the Judicial Service Commission, but we need strong leadership. We need principled, decisive, interventive, active, kick-in-the-butt leadership. And I hope I'm not being too controversial to say at the moment we don't have it. But on the other hand, we also need civic action, Kate. The distress that you've expressed is there. And we need people. We've got the political parties, whether you want to reform the governing party or join one of the new coalitions or join one of the existing opposition parties. There are many ways. Outside politics, there are many ways to fix our country. There's so many. One of the legacies of apartheid, Kate, is our flourishing non-governmental sector. We've got associations for disabled people, for children, for survivors of sexual abuse, for women, for LGBTI people like myself, for people with AIDS. We've got a flourishing NGO sector. Get involved. You can volunteer your skills, your teaching. So there are many things that your listeners and viewers can do to fix our country. We don't have to say, well, wait for the big man. We've had enough of big men. Start with ourselves.
You make a point there about, you talked in the book at one stage about, I want to talk about prisons. You talked about visiting prisons, and you talked about a couple of little prisons in the Eastern Cape where they were really doing so well. They had vegetable gardens. They were really trying to work with the prisoners. But then you say, kind of blanket-wise, in all the nation, there are no people to person these prisons. Nobody wants to be a prison guard, and maybe I'm totally stereotyping people. Does somebody wants to be a prison guard? I don't know, I'm going into stereotyping here, but you make the point there's a dreadful shortage. I go to prison as a young person, I think, maybe I'll try and get my matric. There's nobody to teach me. There's absolutely nobody to teach me. How do we change public perception that prisons, we don't want to go into them, we might be raped, we might be murdered even, you know, with careless guards or whatever. How do we change, obviously your book changes perceptions, how do we change perceptions? How do we bring in the human factor?
Lovely, Kate. Let me start where you started, which is that, like many things in our country, it's a mixed bag. We give the good news stories. We give the story of Ms. Zodwa Khadebe, who starts a counselling program at Pretoria CMAX where people are kept in their cells alone for days and years on end. She starts a counselling program. She has group sessions. I say to her, who's guarding you in those group sessions? She says, no one. So we have heroes. We have the centre that you mentioned in Northern KwaZulu-Natal, Ekuseni, a well-run youth centre. The dark spot on Ekuseni is that there's a magnificent a workshop sitting on the hill which is unused because of lack of personnel, which you mentioned. Well, we think that's wrong. We think that they should appoint personnel to ensure that people are skilled. And it'll work, Kate. We saw at Durban Westville, we saw where they introduced a workshop to let people work their hands. The violence level in Durban Westville, that particular center, went down. So it's a cumulative effort that we can make, excuse me, to improve things and to make the good news stories prevalent, not as they are at the moment, just shining spots in a darker tapestry.
And then how do you motivate people to have a good cough?
Thank you.
My mother used to say, have a good cough. How do you motivate people to go into prison service? Or I suppose you give them better pay. I think in some way, you know, after I read your book, I went totally off into La La Land. I thought, here am I, a retired teacher. I would just love to go into prisons and teach whatever, matric or whatever. And then I thought, come on, Kate, as they say in Ireland, catch yourself on. How can you suddenly go into a prison? But is there room? I'm not talking about myself now. Is there room for volunteers?
Let me say this, Kate, going back to what you said, you'd be safe.
Yeah.
These prisoners are not monsters. There are some monsters, and we know that they have to be locked up for long and locked up securely. We never deny that. We're not pie in the sky. But, Kate, there is a provision in the Prisons Act that says that the National Commissioner may let basically do-good outfits, non-governmental organizations, often religious groupings. I'm going to a ceremony at Sondervater today, fortnight, for a program called Heartwork that works with prisoners, takes them back to the crime they committed. This is not looking forward and leaving out the past. It's taking the past into account. I'm going to their graduation. Mary Nell in Stellenbosch University has got a program at Brandvlei called the Ubuntu Learning Center, where people are taken through. So there is a lot happening, but not enough. So it's not an idle thought, Kate, that you could teach and you'd be fantastic. And absolutely, I've known you for so many years and you're inspirational in many ways. But Kate, so all of this is remediable. There's nothing in our country that is irremediable if we start in the right place, which starts with ourselves, and if we do it correctly, and we need to create the opportunities. Going back to your question, we need to create far more well-based, sensible, well-directed programs of intervention in our prisons, and we can do that.
And I'm just thinking while you're talking here, is there a role for big business, for corporations, is there any role for the private sector to come into this and help?
We try to get Business Against Crime to help us. We wanted tablets. We've got prison monitors. It's a wonderful system, and we've got too few. We've got about 180 prison monitors at 240 prisons. So we need more, and we're going to appoint more. We're not going to have head office appointments. We're going to have the people who are on the ground going into the prisons every day, taking complaints, warning us of hunger strikes, warning us that there's going to be a suicide, and then we can intervene at the judicial inspectorate. So, Kate, carry on.
No, I'm just thinking, you went into prisons, you visited so many prisons. First of all, I know you're a person of great empathy, but it must have been incredibly distressing to hear and see some of the things you saw. How did you deal with that?
Kate, let me say very personally and without self-indulgence that every visit, every time I go into a prison, it knocks you in the stomach. And I do this job because I wanted the job, and I do it willingly, and I do it because I think my colleagues at JICS, the Judicial Inspectorate, do make a difference. We know they make a difference. So I'm inspired by the people who do much more than I do. But you cannot go into a prison without being kicked in the butt and knocked in the stomach. It's always a sobering and sometimes distressing experience. The same Mossel Bay prison we saw the remandees. They were youth. They were under 21, these youngsters, Kate. We went to the children's section. We saw these very tender-eared kids. As I said, the youngest 15, from the Cape Flats, sent to Mossel Bay. We went into a remand cell, which was one of the worst that I saw. It was more than you said. It's not in the book. About 80 people. They had their mattresses on top of the lockers. So, Kate, and to go back to the point that you make earlier about personnel, we've got lots of personnel, over 30,000 personnel, with a big budget, a budget of over 30 billion, which we believe can be better directed within the correctional service. We don't blame the correctional officers, but all of that just to say that the overcrowding in Mossel Bay and those youngsters was, I wouldn't say it, traumatic sounds too self-referential, but yeah. I think that too few of us know the reality. That remand cell at Mossel Bay, like the remand cell in Durban Westville that we visited last year, those are experiences which are unforgettable. And what do you do with an unforgettable experience? You try to write a book so that people can engage with the issue and can become aware of it and can consider.
I want to, a couple more questions I want to ask you, but I want to show you this book. Please read it. Please read it. It is so eye-opening, and it will give you a totally, or maybe not totally, but it will widen your horizons enormously. Because I think somewhere, Edwin, you say, or the blurb on the back says, you know, we all think people are in prison, or they deserve to be there, they've done something wrong, and we live in a society of violent crime. Lock them up. And we know now the reality is very different from what you've told us about being arraigned and these youngsters. And it's very distressing. Now, a kind of broader ethical question, which has just occurred to me too. You've always been a champion of justice. You are a South African champion of justice, compassion, empathy. After your experiences in visiting these prisons and writing the book with your co-authors, has your definition in your head of justice changed? It's a very broad question.
And it's a deep question, Kate. I was scared you were going to ask me, has my definition of evil changed?
Because Edwin, I'm sorry to come in here. People often ask me about evil and good and evil. And I don't know, either I'm very innocent or I'm not, I'm very cynical. I've been very lucky or whatever. I don't believe in my entire very, very long life, I have ever truly met an evil person. Maybe I didn't recognize it, but Edwin, we're going to have that discussion another time about evil. No, I'm not asking you about evil. I'm asking you about your paradigm for justice. Has your definition, your own personal definition of justice changed?
Kate, I'm going to be slightly evasive because I want to tell you why.
You're allowed to be.
Well, I
you're
was
a lawyer.
Exactly. Kate, I was visiting prisons as a judge before I became inspecting judge. So I've had a consistent exposure over 3+ decades. And it has changed my view of justice. I think in almost every corner of our administration of justice, we need to do what we say in the book you should do, which is to the immediate things you can do, and we set them out in the book, the medium-term things that you can do, and the longer-term things that we can do. I would say the same of the police, I would say the same of the National Prosecuting Authority, and primarily I would say the same of crime intelligence. So, Kate, you ask me whether it's changed my view of justice. I would say it hasn't changed anything that I didn't know before, but it's given me an added sense of urgency that we've got this beautiful country. This is not a sentimental thing. We've had today in Johannesburg, we've had a day of quite perfection of autumn. I know it's been hot in Cape Town. We live in a wonderful country with wonderful people. Not, again, bleeding heart sentimentality. There are wonderful people that you encounter every day in our country. And there are, I think, evil people. I'm not going to define evil. So, Kate, I don't think there's been a radical reshift, but it's given me a sense of urgency about what we can do and what we're able to do and what we can improve, starting right away with this talk tonight.
And you were just talking about Johannesburg. I'm sitting here in front of my laptop. I can hear a robin singing. I can smell jasmine coming in. Look, I'm privileged. I know that. But there is so much good. And maybe as a final kind of thing, and I'd like to hear you say this, we have the best constitution in the entire world, don't we?
It sets it all out, Kate. Justice, equality, dignity, non-discrimination, and most importantly, I believe, Kate, the minimum material conditions of life for everyone. You and I, sitting in our studies, we cannot rest in conscience, we cannot rest in safety or security until everyone in our country has, we've got enough food in our country, we've got enough resources, we just need to apply ourselves to making justice real for everyone and making the constitution real for everyone.
I think so. And I think, like you, I'm incredibly positive, because you get these doom mongers, things aren't what they used to be. No, of course things aren't what they used to be. Some things are better, some things are worse, but as you say, we've got all the raw materials, ethically, morally, the will. So let's go. Let's go. Thank you so, so much. I've been talking with Judge Edwin Cameron, who needs no introduction internationally or locally. And Edwin, please, at some stage, can we debate evil? Can we debate good and evil? I would love to. I would love to do that. Thank you so, so much. And as I say, I urge you all to read the book, because just looking at the photographs will change your whole view of prison and prison life. And we didn't get to it because we didn't have time. I mean, this is also a global problem. But thanks so much for being with us today. I always say we didn't get on to travel today, but I always say to you, travel safely, look after yourselves, and of course, look after other people too.